Local mental health officials look for needed funding. Good morning. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Bank, in for Melissa Ross. We're always live here at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. You can also catch up on all our shows at wjctnews.org or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, Duval County is in line for a grant that could raise millions of dollars for mental health care. 549-2937, that's the number to call. Then later, helping families who are victims of air crashes. Plus, after another disappointing loss, the Jaguars have parted ways with head coach Gus Bradley. Culpepper joins us to talk about what's next for the Jags. All of that and more ahead, but first this hour. It's been a major concern in Northeast Florida for years, a lack of funding for mental health services. Florida as a state ranks 49th out of 50 in funding for mental health and substance abuse. But local health officials hope a new state grant might help change that. To talk about the grant, we are now joined by Dr. Bob Summers, CEO of Mental Health Resource Center in Jacksonville. Dr. Summers, thanks for being here this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
What are your thoughts about the state of mental health treatment and funding in Duval County? Give us a call and let us know at 549-2937. So there's been some tepid success for mental health advocates the past couple legislative sessions. According to a recent JCCI implementation report, with the help of Duval County legislators, Tallahassee approved a pilot program to divert people with mental illness from jail, standardize mental health courts, and secure some funding for what's called a central receiving system or central receiving facility. This facility or system has been described as a one-stop shop for those struggling with mental illness. Instead of being arrested or committed to a state hospital, a person can receive short-term treatment, be connected with disability-related benefits, or even be referred to other long-term resources. But that program won't pay for itself. Dr. Summers, can you start off by telling me a little bit about Mental Health Resource Center in Jacksonville and what you do here?
Yes. Mental Health Resource Center, also known as MHRC, is a nonprofit community mental health center here in Jacksonville. We employ over 400 people and are the largest provider of mental health services in the area. We have a variety of different programs currently, ranging from emergency and inpatient crisis stabilization services to many different outpatient programs, which perhaps we can talk about later.
Yeah, definitely. Well, talking specifically about this state grant, can you tell me about how Duval County intends to pay for this facility or this system? And maybe we should back up a little bit and talk about what exactly a central receiving facility or a central receiving system is. Can you tell our listeners what that is?
Sure. Well, originally, the grant was called Central Receiving Facility. And some communities, they are, in fact, have one facility to which police will bring people for involuntary evaluations, or people can go for evaluations. However, in this grant, they later changed the name to Centralized Receiving System because different cities around the state are using the funds to do different types of services, not necessarily in one new facility. Here in Jacksonville, we have two main facilities. One is on the north side, 20th Street and Edgewood Avenue, and one is on the south side at Beach Boulevard near I-295, right across the street from Florida State College. So we have two large facilities now, which are, in fact, Baker Act receiving facilities. Police do bring individuals there now for involuntary evaluations. People also come in voluntarily. So our proposal is to use the grant funds to add some additional inpatient crisis stabilization beds at our Beach Boulevard facility. And the other interesting new component, though, is to establish a comprehensive services center at our North facility. And the comprehensive services center is, as you described earlier, sort of a one-stop shop. We'll have employees there, not only from MHRC, but we'll have substance abuse clinicians from Gateway Community Services. We'll have other staff from Mental Health America and River Region Human Services. So we'll have four different agencies. We'll all be working together to provide a multitude of services to the community.
What are your questions about mental health funding in Northeast Florida, and specifically the central proposed central receiving facility or central receiving system? Give us a call, 549-2937, or comment on our Facebook page. So let's talk a little bit about what this grant is. How much is it for, and what are the stipulations? What does Duval County have to do in order to receive this state grant?
Okay. Well, the grant was awarded to MHRC, but we haven't actually received any funding yet.
Right.
And we won't receive any funding until we start providing these new services. So the state grant is for almost $3 million a year for 5 years. But to receive the funds, we need local match funds. It's required that you have at least half that amount in local match funds. So you need $1.5 million in local match to pull down the $3 million in the state.
And that would be $1.5 million a year?
Yes, each year. However, we actually need $3 million per year because our original proposal costs $6 million a year. So we actually need $3 million in local match funding to do all of the services that we propose to do.
So, excuse me, let me back up for a second and ask you about how many people does the Resource Center serve currently?
Currently we serve probably 10,000 people a year. Just last year, for example, we had 8,000 admissions to our inpatient crisis stabilization program.
Wow. What are some of the... some of the examples of these services? You know, when you say crisis stabilization, what does that mean? I mean, how long is the average stay for someone who is receiving services?
Okay, well, inpatient crisis stabilization is the same as inpatient psychiatric treatment as you would find in any psychiatric unit or hospital. A person comes in, they're given a physical exam by a physician assistant. They are evaluated by a psychiatrist or, in some cases, a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. And then, of course, they receive medication and counseling and a discharge plan. The average length of stay at our facility is about 4 days. Some, of course, are shorter. Some are a little bit longer. And, of course, we provide a follow-up plan so that people can then continue in their treatment coming to our outpatient programs.
Dr. Summers, how exactly are you looking to come up with the matching funds that are necessary? If those funds, first of all, if those funds aren't, if you can't find those funds, what happens with the grant? Do you not receive the grant at all? It doesn't work.
Okay. Well, in terms of seeking the matching funds, we will be talking to foundations and donors, of course. If anyone would like to donate, they can go to our website, mhrcflorida.com, learn more about the project, and they can donate there. But we'll also be approaching the city. The city does provide some matching funds for our current programs, and we're hoping that they can increase that amount so we can use the state funds. The Comprehensive Service Center that I described earlier, as I mentioned, it's going to have a variety of different services. Mental health assessments and counseling, substance abuse assessments and counseling. We'll also be helping individuals to obtain government benefits if they're entitled to Social Security income, Medicaid, and other things. So getting back to your question, the Comprehensive Services Center is something that we believe so strongly in that we're already going ahead and remodeling our outpatient area to accommodate it. And we have some of our own funding that we're going to use just to get it started on a pilot basis, hopefully in March of 2017. So we hope to start that at least Monday through Friday from 8 to 5. But if we get the matching funds and can pull down all of the state grants, then we're going to operate it every day, including weekends, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. So it'll really expand the services even more.
Now, you know, it's no secret that the state itself will be entering will have a much thinner budget next year. But it's also no secret that here in Jacksonville, there's a debt issue. Our mayor has been, since he's been elected, he's been hammering this unfunded liability for pensions. Have you spoken already with city officials regarding increasing matching funds from the city for this program?
I've only had a couple of preliminary meetings, and we hope to follow up on that in, after the new year. Yes, I mean, the city has other issues, of course, but this is a rare opportunity to pull down state funds for Jacksonville. Six or seven other cities also got the grant, and they're all finding funds to pull down the state funds to improve services in their area. So I'm hoping that we can do the same in Jacksonville. I've been the CEO of Mental Health Resource Center for 24 years, and the state funding and the city funding has basically remained the same all of that time. So this is extremely rare to get this much money to expand mental health services. And if we don't use these funds, I guess the state will take it back and give it to some other city. It'll be very disappointing.
Again, the number to call is 549-2937. We would like your thoughts on the Central Receiving Facility, Central Receiving Program, and mental health funding more generally in Northeast Florida. Why is something like this receiving facility? We hear a lot of talk about mental health care funding in Florida in general being pretty abysmal, like 49 out of 50. But why is something like a facility like this or a program like this so necessary specifically in Duval County?
Well, the demand for services is much larger than the services that we currently have available. I mean, right now, if a person wants to see a psychiatrist in Jacksonville, you might have to wait 3 or 4 weeks or more just to get an appointment. The Comprehensive Service Center is going to be like an urgent care center where we will give appointments, but it'll also be available on a walk-in basis. So you could just come right in and you'll see a mental health professional that day. If you're suffering from an emotional crisis or you have a mental health issue, you don't want to have to wait 3 or 4 weeks or more. So that's another reason that we're looking forward to doing the program.
Now, in terms of finding funding from foundations or other nonprofits or even local citizens, is there any campaign that you are being ready to launch or have already launched in order to make that a reality and kind of crowdsource as much of that funding as you can?
Well, we haven't developed an organized campaign such as you described yet. We're in the process of doing that now. Our original proposal with the state was that we would start this program actually in July of 2017. But as it turns out, the state then said, well, the funding can be available sooner if you'd like to get started sooner. So we're kind of pushing to start the Comprehensive Service Center on a small scale in March. But we really weren't planning to get started until July. But we are going to be doing the fundraising, as you mentioned.
So, I had the chance to speak to some other mental health advocates around town, specifically at the release of this JCCI implementation report. Basically, they looked at the goals that the mental health advocate community had legislatively, and then they matched it with what they were able to accomplish and came up with how well they implemented those goals. Now, speaking with some of them, there was kind of an air of pessimism moving forward, being that last year last legislative session was probably the last of a pretty hearty budget. We're looking at climbing into another deficit here for the state, which hasn't happened in the last few years, and so they're a little pessimistic that moving forward there will be even slower progress when it comes to funding programs or starting programs, pilot programs in other counties. Do you share that pessimism at all?
Well, it's hard to predict what the state legislature will do. I mean, I'm certainly not counting on any additional funds. But again, the $3 million from the state for this program is already earmarked and set aside, is my understanding.
Right.
So that's that's there and it's available for us. All we have to do is come up with the matching funds.
Now, coming up with those matching funds, and of course that is set in stone already, that those funds will come if you're able to find the matching funds. But in terms of, you know, after the 5 years, I mean, where does that leave MHRC, you know, once the grant ends?
Right. Well, the grant, as I say, is there for up to 5 years. My experience is that when the state has found funding for special programs like this, they generally will continue it beyond the initial period if the program is effective. So, and I believe it will be very effective. So I think even after the 5 years, the state will continue the funding. I'm also hoping that more people will have health insurance 5 years from now than have it today. And with the health insurance, of course, they'll be able to pay for their own services. We won't have so many uninsured people that depend on the state and city funding for their services.
That brings up some other issues as well in terms of doctor shortages, because even if when you have an increased amount of coverage, you still have an issue with not having enough mental health professionals. But we'll put that on hold and we'll move to a call. This is Till in Avondale. Till, how are you?
Hello.
What's your question?
Not really a question, more of a comment. I just wanted to say it seems like we're always hearing about how our local law enforcement are having to cope on the really hard and difficult end with mental illness. And I was thinking maybe he could either make friends with the police or have some kind of coalition or letter or something, because it seems like they would really be strong advocates of any kind of help the community could receive in that manner.
Sure. Well, thank you, Till. So to her question, what about partnering with law enforcement to raise these funds or any other partnership that can kind of help get this program off the ground? Have you been speaking to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office?
Yes. And yes, in fact, we've had one meeting with the Sheriff Mike Williams, and we'll be meeting with him again in the very near future. And we do have a very strong relationship with JSO.
He's been the sheriff has been very supportive of this, these types of programs.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we participate with the sheriff's office in what's called the crisis intervention team, in which the police are all trained in how to best manage individuals with mental illness when they encounter them.
And of course, you know, we do know because of the state of our mental health delivery system here in this state, you know, jails and prisons are kind of like the mental health facilities of our time, and people struggling with mental illness or substance abuse are more likely to have run-ins with the law. And a facility like this or a program like this is specifically meant to work with law enforcement, correct?
Exactly. The right now we have two staff that are based in the jail. And they evaluate people who are arrested. And if an individual with a mental illness has committed a minor offense, they are diverted to our mental health services currently. And when people are released from jail, they are also referred for mental health services. But the problem now is, okay, they're referred for the follow-up mental health services, but they may not be able to get an appointment for 2 or 3 weeks or more. And in the meantime, you can sort of lose track of them, or they lose their motivation, they don't follow through, they don't keep their appointment. With the Comprehensive Service Center, we plan to get them right in, either that day or within the next day or two. And we'll have care managers that will closely monitor the individual to encourage them to stick with the program and continue to come in.
Essentially, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, instead of taking these people to jail, these officers can take them to one of these receiving facilities in town, where they can be connected with the services they need to ensure that they don't get rearrested, they don't reoffend, or there isn't another run-in with the law.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we have another call. This is Peter in Jack's Beach. Peter, how are you? You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Fine, thanks. Your speaker mentioned that funding might well continue if the program was effective. So the question really is, how will the effectiveness of the program be evaluated? What's the criteria?
Sure. Thanks, Peter. So, yeah, how will the program be evaluated to ensure that the grant continues? What is the measuring stick there?
Okay. Well, the state has not developed a precise measuring stick yet, but we have many, many measures that we use to evaluate the effectiveness of programs. For example, we'll have individuals with mental illness who may have been arrested or hospitalized several times. Now they come into our program, we will track them to see if they continue with our services and whether or not that has reduced the number of their hospitalizations and the number of their arrests. One of our programs, for example, the Florida Certified Community Treatment Program, is a specialized intensive program where we do track that data, and that has demonstrated conclusively that we have reduced the number of arrests and hospitalizations for people in that program. So we'll be developing those sorts of measures to ensure the effectiveness.
You know, speaking of tracking people that come through these programs to kind of ensure that there's some follow-through and that they can be successful, we know that there's this very large intersection between people with mental illness and substance abuse issues and homelessness.
Right.
Tracking someone who is homeless is very difficult. A lot of nonprofits around town have said this many times before. How is it that if you have someone who comes in who maybe isn't stable enough to have a stable home, how do you keep track of that person?
Right. Well, we actually have two programs that serve the homeless right now, and the Comprehensive Service Center will be in addition to that. One of the things, of course, you try to do is help this individual obtain Social Security disability income or Social Security income so that they can afford housing. Our two current homeless programs can provide some temporary rent assistance, and the Comprehensive Service Center will provide other additional services. So, we do hope to get them into housing and to be able to keep track of them. Within our own programs, we are right now implementing a new electronic health record system, so all of our programs and medical records will be integrated. So anyone who comes into our system, no matter what program they access our system, they'll be in our, we'll have their record and we'll be able to keep track of it that way. Of course, there will be some homeless individuals who might leave town and, you lose track of them in that sense.
Right.
But as long as they remain here within our programs, we should be able to monitor them.
You know, and that there's another, this is just such a complicated issue. Mental health is such a complicated thing because we also have the intersection of, our veterans in Jacksonville being such a large veteran town. We have a lot of veterans who come home who aren't connecting with the services that they've duly earned. And I think, how is it, is there a different way of dealing with that? There might be people walking around who don't know they qualify for certain services.
I mean, right.
How do you go about figuring out what someone qualifies for?
Right. Well, and I hope I don't sound too repetitious,
right.
but the Comprehensive Service Center, again, is ideally designed to help that individual, the veteran, or anyone. That's the beauty of the center, is anyone can come there. If you're a veteran having any kind of mental health or substance abuse issue, you would come there. And we will have a staff that are called community resource specialists. These are individuals who are very familiar with all of the different resources available in town, the housing options, food stamps, how do you get Medicaid benefits. And then we have another type of staff which specialize in helping people get Social Security disability income. So all you have to do is, when the center is up and running, you would just have to come in, you can call for an appointment, or you can just walk in and the staff will be there ready to help you answer all of those questions.
So I have just two more questions for you. What a lot of advocates are thinking about right now is that we have a new administration coming in D.C. We have President-elect Donald Trump, who has basically said he's going to be taking a much different tact with how he funds health care than what President Obama has. And we've already seen the overhaul because of Obamacare, because of the Affordable Care Act. You had said earlier about hoping that coverage rate, that insurance coverage rate, continues to climb in the future. But there are some who aren't so sure that's going to happen because we just don't know how the system will be again reformed. Is that something you worry about at all?
Right. Well, yes, we're all worried about that. No one knows what the new healthcare system or funding will be like. And certainly, if the Affordable Care Act is repealed and nothing replaces it, there will be millions of people who got health insurance and Medicaid benefits under that plan who will lose their coverage. Hopefully that will not happen. That's really all that I think anyone can say at this point, since no one really knows for sure what the new system will look like.
Well, Dr. Summers, how can regular people, regular citizens in town, get involved? Either donate to make this program, these matching funds, a reality, to ensure that that grant does stay here in Duval County, or to just volunteer in general their time. If somebody wants to get involved, how can they get involved?
Okay. Well, again, please visit our website, mhrcflorida.com. You can read about all of our programs at that website. And you can also read about the Centralized Receiving System Project. And you can make donations through that website as well. And we haven't really begun meeting with the city council members yet, but we will do that right after the new year. So you can begin getting ready to write your city council member in support of the program.
Okay. Well, Dr. Bob Summers is the CEO of Mental Health Resource Center in Jacksonville. Dr. Summers, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Much more still ahead. Later, Karen Brune-Mathis talks with InMotion President Jeremy Smith in the latest installment of First Coast Success. But up next, serving the legal needs of the victims of air crashes. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, members of the Electoral College meet in the States to vote for president and vice president. Some members of Congress say the electors should get an intelligence briefing on the Russian hacking allegations, controversy over the Electoral College, and calls for electors to vote their conscience.
Weekday mornings at 10 on 89.9.
When you're experiencing the in-depth content of WJCT, you know there's always something more to explore, regardless of the device. It's a special commitment sharing the world, and as such, WJCT is an indispensable service here on the First Coast. Truth is, however, that such content, whether you access it via television, radio, or various digital platforms, is expensive. Costs that are largely funded by people like you. So please, during this season of giving, stand up now for your cherished values of curiosity and excellence with your vital year-end investment. Your support makes it possible for WJCT to continue to share your community, your world. Do so today at WJCT.org. Thank you.
Welcome back. Recent air disasters have been in the headlines, including tragedies in Pakistan and Colombia. When a family or even a company is impacted by an airline crash, particularly when it's an international crash, it can be difficult to receive proper legal help. Local law firm Spohr and Dodd has a great deal of experience dealing with these international air crashes. Attorneys Barry Newman and Keith Maynard of Spohr and Dodd join us now. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I just want to start off, I'm not sure who wants to take the lead here, but I want to start off with just explaining exactly what it is that you do.
Well, typically we represent the families of folks who were injured or killed in airplane crashes, civilian, military, light commercial, general aviation.
General aviation. Okay. What are some of the cases that you're working on right now?
One of the cases we have in particular is actually a military crash that took place a little over 2 years ago in Afghanistan. It was two Pennsylvania National Guard Apache pilots. In all military crashes, if it's a soldier that's injured, they can't actually sue the military. So you need to sort of look at what the cause of the accident was. If it was pure pilot error, then that's probably something that a family member is not going to be able to recover for. But in this case, we believe, we know that a piece of the aircraft malfunctioned. The aircraft was manufactured by a big manufacturer in the country. And so the lawsuit was brought against the manufacturer, so it becomes more of a products liability type case against the manufacturer.
And this is sort of common, correct, to do an investigation and figure out that there was some type of malfunction of maybe of a specific part of an aircraft, and then you have to kind of litigate with the company that create the manufacturer of that part, correct?
It depends on every plane crash is different. And what we like to say is, as the NTSB says frequently, we don't like to jump to speculation. We look at all aspects of the crash, and usually there's some combination of facts that combine to cause a tragedy, you know, something between the man, the pilot, the weather, air traffic control, environmental factors, products liability, defects, those types of things typically combine to cause a crash.
Now, we were speaking earlier before we got on the air about the difference or the relative safety or difference with this litigation when it comes to kind of commercial aircraft. Can you tell me a little bit about what you were saying earlier about commercial aircrafts and you know, how safe they are?
Sure. In large part, commercial aviation has become so safe that there's really not a lot of litigation that involves crashes like this one in Colombia, for instance. Most of the litigation that involves big airlines is somebody tripping while they're getting onto the plane. Maybe some luggage falls off and hits somebody in the head. But as a general matter, commercial aviation is so safe now that most of the cases that we handle either involve military crashes or general aviation, which is, you know, doctors and lawyers that are out there flying their planes around. And there's some combination of mistakes that are made between perhaps an air traffic controller, perhaps someone on the pilot, and could be a maintenance issue, and there could also be issues with the product itself, the airplane, or a piece in it.
Right, and those would be kind of your small 1-2 person planes that, you know, a private pilot is driving, right, or flying.
That's correct. And it could even be, you know, recently we had a case where a large family was actually on a plane and they were killed. But you also have, you know, your smaller carriers that aren't necessary. They might be like corporate planes and those types of things where you might have an accident. But the large, you know, airliners predominantly, you know, there's not a lot of litigation involving them.
Yeah, that gives me, as I mentioned, I'll be on a plane very soon. I always get very nervous flying. That gives me a little bit of comfort to know that. But, you know, at the same time, there's these stories coming out about these sort of very cheap airlines, these short trips for very, very small airfare. People see, you know, you can fly somewhere one way for under $50, and they're excited by this. And we've seen in the news somewhere like something like Allegiant Air as well has had a lot of malfunctions and issues like that. I mean, are we moving into a period where maybe commercial flying could actually become less safe than it has before?
You know, commercial aviation is safer now than it's ever been. The FAA is very proactive and watching over the airlines. But that said, as the aircraft equipment gets older, you certainly, just like with a used car, you have more problems pop up later. The life-limited parts start to wear out. And aviation is fueled by money. You know, aviation is turning money into noise, basically. So when you have a situation where an airline is skimping, they have to take it from somewhere. Either they're paying their pilots less, their mechanics less, they're spending less on maintenance. You know, it's got to come from somewhere.
Now, do you always work with one, once a plane has crashed, is that the only litigation you work on, or once a plane has had an emergency landing that probably shouldn't have happened? You know, we've heard some of these stories from Allegiant Air. The Washington Post most recently had a big expose on that.
Well, we work with all sorts of crashes and incidents involving aviation. So it doesn't necessarily mean that an aircraft went down. Sometimes, as I said before, it could be somebody being injured as a result of an in-air emergency or something that happened, like smoke filling the plane, or you've heard of people where their phones are catching on fire, or, you know, extreme turbulence where maybe somebody's not buckled in. There's any number of incidents that we look into. It doesn't mean that everyone ultimately ends up with a lawsuit, but we look into all sorts of accidents, and it could be as simple as, like I said, somebody having a piece of luggage fall on their head and they injure their neck, or they, you know, think they have whiplash or something of that sort, up into, you know, a full aircraft crash. So
it does have to be an injury, though. We don't represent people who have lost luggage or they've been inconvenienced because they missed a wedding. That's not really what lawsuits are for.
Right. This is definitely someone must be injured. There has to be some type of, I mean, in many cases, I don't see how it wouldn't be a traumatic experience to be injured on an aircraft like that. What are your tips to people who are maybe actually wondering whether or not they have a case? If you have an emergency landing of a plane, if they were injured on a plane, sometimes it's difficult for them to know what their rights are.
Well, it's true. Sometimes people don't realize at first that they've been injured. For example, luggage falling on their head might be more embarrassing initially, and then later they start to incur some pain, and then, you know, in some cases we represented folks who've ended up having to have surgery because of it. That's pretty it. We don't want to litigate a case for somebody who's taking Tylenol. That's not what we do.
Right. But sometimes, as you said, some of these symptoms might not show up for some time. But, I mean, what does Florida law say? I mean, how is it different from car crashes? I mean, what does Florida law allow for a person?
Well, generally, you have to have a physical injury. It's you can't recover for mental suffering. And, you know, the biggest thing is we don't charge somebody to call us and talk to us about their case, you know, and we generally evaluate cases. We have a surgeon that works on our staff, and he helps evaluate cases to determine whether or not there's an injury there that they could recover for. But, you know, a lot of times people, especially if they've lost somebody in you know, like where somebody dies in a plane crash, a lot of times people are dealing with grief initially, and there is a statute of limitations in every state and generally in every country. We handle crashes that happen in other countries. We handle crashes that happen all over the United States. And at any given time, we're litigating all over in any of those places. But the key thing is to talk to an attorney that knows what those laws are, because people are dealing with that grief, and they might wait 2 years, which sounds unreasonable to most people, but unless you're in that situation, you don't know how you're going to deal with it. And the problem is, if that statute of limitations goes by, they can't bring a claim at all.
All right. Well, that's attorneys Barry Newman and Keith Maynard of Spohr and Dodd. Thank you for your advice this morning. Important, especially as everyone is getting ready to travel for the holiday. So I appreciate you being on.
Thank you.
Thanks. Have a safe trip.
Thank you. All right. Well, he's a former top executive at Gate Petroleum. Jeremy Smith is also president of the InMotion Entertainment Company. Based in Jacksonville, the firm has hundreds of InMotion kiosks and stores in airports across the country. Smith shares his secrets with Karen Brune Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record in today's First Coast Success.
If you've ever needed an electronic gadget in a United States airport, you might have visited the InMotion Entertainment store or kiosk. Did you know that the company is based in Jacksonville? It was founded here almost 20 years ago, and when it started, it rented DVD players and movies to airline travelers as InMotion Pictures. Today, it sells chargers, headphones, speakers, portable power, anything you need for your flight, or as the company says, just for fun. It operates almost 120 locations in 42 airports. Pete Jeremy Smith Jr. is the president and CEO of InMotion Entertainment. Welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen. It's good to be with you.
I'm guessing this is a big time of year for InMotion Entertainment in view of all the holiday traveling. How important is this time of year for the company?
Yes, the holiday season, which we define as November and December, is a big time of year for us. Sales typically spike during those 2 months. It's a busy time of year for us. We put on extra staff. As you know, more airport travelers are traveling this time of year. We also have what we call military exoduses from some of the bases that will travel through the airport literally at 3 a.m, and we're open and staffed at that hour. So yes, very busy time of year, but a good time of year.
Well, Jacksonville travelers might have no idea when they see InMotion in the airports that the company is based in Jacksonville, and travelers elsewhere probably don't realize the company is based here either. What sort of a profile does InMotion have, and what are you looking for?
You know, we've been in Jacksonville. We originally started in Jacksonville back in 99. And I would classify us in Jacksonville as maintaining a fairly low profile. Not necessarily by design, it's just the way it happens. Our customers are spread throughout the country, so we're not just focused on Jacksonville, although we do have a store here in the Jacksonville International Airport. But as I said, our stores and customer base is nationwide, so we're spread all over the country. We in Jacksonville quietly go about our business, is the way I'd phrase it.
And it's a big company. How many employees do you have, and what are your sales?
Right now, we have almost 670 employees across the country. We have roughly 55 here in the corporate office and distribution center. Sales next year will run about $140 million.
And that's a big number.
It is a big number when you consider we started with just two locations back in 99.
Talk about that a little bit. How did InMotion get its start, and how long did it rent those DVD players, which I think you now have in a cabinet there for show?
Yes, it's in our history box. This company started in 99, and the concept back then was to rent a movie and or a DVD player while you're traveling. And when you're traveling from point A to point B, drop off your movie and player when you arrive at point B. And that concept worked well, but what we found over the years was more and more people were gravitating towards buying their own electronics. So I would say that from 99 until 2005, we were 50% renting players and movies, but morphing into more of a electronics retailer. And by the end of 2005, we were pretty much through with the rental business.
Talk about what you have now. What is your best seller? And you also have two other brands in addition to InMotion.
Headphones are our primary product. We're known as the headphone experts in the airport market. That's what we're known for. We carry a wide line of headphones, well-known brands. We're also known for demonstrating the headphones to customers, so you can test drive any headphone you wish before you buy it, which is important because everybody's ear is tuned differently. Each ear is different, and whether you want more bass, less bass, etc., you need to test drive those headphones, and that's what we do. And we're known for that customer service. But in addition to the headphones, we're a full-fledged, full-line retailer for electronics and accessories, be it cameras, camcorders, chargers, batteries, splitters. We carry a full line and always have. The other concepts that we have and what we've developed over the year, the InMotion Entertainment Store is our flagship concept, but we also developed a concept called Sound Balance, which again is an electronics retail store, but it also was designed to carry environmentally friendly electronics, accessories, either in the unit itself or because of the packaging. The Marley brand is a good example of that. The other concept that we have is called Headphone Hub. And that store specifically concentrates on headphones. It might carry a few other accessories, but not the full line of product that our InMotion stores do.
You have a lot of experience. You were formerly a senior executive for many years with Gate Petroleum Company, which invested in InMotion in the year 2000. And how did that lead to you taking the presidency of InMotion?
Yes, when Gate made a small investment in InMotion in the year 2000. I went on the board of directors for InMotion. Over time, Gate's investment grew as the company grew, so we funded their growth. And in 2005, we made a rather large acquisition of one of our competitors in the market. And shortly after that, the founders of the company decided to leave. And so I assumed the role of president on a part-time basis because I still had duties at Gate. So I went from director to part-time president. And then when the company was sold in 2013, the new owners asked me to come on board as a full-time president and CEO. And that's where I am today.
3 years ago, the private equity investors bought into the company and the company refocused. What will happen next?
We still have a lot of opportunities in the U.S. airport market. We're in 22 of the top 25 airports, but within those 22, there's still opportunities, what I call infill opportunities. While we may have 16 stores in Atlanta, we only have one store in LAX, Los Angeles. So that's a good example where a major airport, we're underserved there.
Well, Jeremy Smith, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been very enjoyable. Appreciate it.
Finally, this hour, it's one blown lead too many and a long flight home for Gus Bradley. After losing a team record ninth straight game, the Jaguars finally had enough and fired head coach Gus Bradley. To talk about what's next for the Jaguars, we are joined by First Coast Connect sports analyst Cole Pepper. Cole Pepper, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Why now?
Well, I think the record is one thing you have to look at and say this is 14-48. some would say, why not sooner? A lot of fans thought that this should have happened after last year, but Shad Khan wanted to give, and Dave Caldwell, the general manager, wanted to give Gus Bradley one more year to try to get things going. Last year, Gus had a team that struggled, but did have some moments, and a lot of those moments came with Blake Bortles playing well late in games. He put up big numbers last year. The quarterback didn't perform this year, and there's a general sense that there wasn't enough expectation put on the players, that there wasn't anything behind the expectation. Gus Bradley is a player's coach, and if you've spent any time with Gus at any point, he's a terrific positive energy guy. You'd love him as a neighbor, right? You'd never have to worry about anything. You just have this positive energy next door. Problem is, there wasn't enough being pushed to the players in terms of here's how you have to go about things, and if you don't do it the right way, you know, the discipline, you know,
he just wasn't tough on them.
He wasn't tough enough, and I think his approach is to let the players police the locker room, which can work if you have enough veterans who are real pros. And the Jaguars have some of those. They don't have enough. They have too many young players, too many guys who haven't proven themselves in the National Football League. And guys, frankly, they weren't policing themselves as well. A number of the players tweeting last night that, hey, sorry, coach, we let you down, that sort of thing. One player, Roy Miller, said that he thought Gus was a mastermind and that he was ahead of his time. This may all be the case, but it just didn't work here. Time after time after time, and now the Jaguars will be looking to the future.
So I've got kind of a compound question then. Where do you think Bradley goes after this, and who do you think may replace him?
Well, he is under contract. Gus Bradley is for next year. He'll still get paid whether he coaches or not, but I think he'll get picked up somewhere. I mean, he is a good football coach. He may not have been a good head football coach, but he's a good football coach, and there's a difference there. So as a defensive coordinator or a defensive assistant somewhere, if Gus Bradley wants to work in 2017, I think he'll have a job. He's also, again, as I mentioned, exceedingly well-liked around the National Football League. Who the Jaguars will go with, of course, is the huge question now. Typically, when you fire a coach, you go for the 180-degree opposite of his style. So Gus Bradley is a defensive-minded players coach. So typically, you would expect an offensive-minded disciplinarian, and there's one of those available, a guy by the name of Tom Coughlin. Now, will Tom come back to Jacksonville? He lives in Atlantic Beach. He still maintains a residence here. He's been working for the NFL, and he has said he wants to get back into the game. The question is, most recently he's talked about maybe wanting to be in a management role rather than a coaching role. So we'll see what happens there. A number of names will crop up. Josh McDaniels is the offensive coordinator of the Patriots, but Patriots assistants typically don't do well going somewhere else because they don't have Tom Brady, who, and he's not bringing Tom Brady with him to Jacksonville. Another interesting name that I think a lot of people will recognize is going to crop up is Mike Smith, former defensive coordinator here and former head coach of the Atlanta Falcons. He was in Atlanta when Dave Caldwell was an assistant GM with the Falcons, so there's a relationship there. Very well-liked guy as well, but a defensive-minded guy. Now he's the defensive coordinator with Tampa Bay, and the Buccaneers are having a very good year this year as well. You'll hear some of the familiar names like Bill Cowher and John Gruden and Tony Dungy. I don't think any of those guys are going to be really in the mix. Cowher, maybe a 5 or 10% chance. The rest, though, aren't going to come back to coaching. They're doing too well being TV stars, and I don't think that's going to happen at all. One other name I'll throw out there. And I haven't heard this from a direct source, but a guy who I think bears mentioning is David Shaw, who's the head coach at Stanford. Now, typically, college coaches don't necessarily make a great transition to the pros, but he has been an assistant in the NFL. His father played in the National Football League, and he's very well regarded around the league. And Stanford, a little different situation than a lot of other colleges, as you can imagine. So keep an eye, see if David Shaw doesn't have his name pop up into the conversation over the next couple of weeks.
So the last question here is, you know, what will other coaches think about getting this job in Jacksonville? Will other coaches want this job? I mean, isn't there kind of like a steep hill to climb here?
Well, there is in some regard, but I think here are the factors that coaches will think about when they look at this job. Number one, the owner. Number two, the roster as it stands, and specifically the quarterback. You'll look strongly at that. And then also, will there be resources and opportunities to improve here, and will there be patience? Well, Gus Bradley was given all kinds of patience here, so you'd say that's probably a yes. Shad Khan is going to open up the wallet and pay what he needs to if he thinks that that's the right guy. Question mark on Bortles. You don't know if that's what's going to happen, and a big question that Dave Caldwell is going to have of those candidates is, what do you think about this quarterback? Can we repair him? Can we get him back on the track, or are we looking at a rebuild and finding a new franchise quarterback?
All right. Well, that's First Coast Connect sports analyst Cole Pepper. Cole, thanks for being on the show, as always.
Thanks, Ryan.
And that's our show for today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, members of the Electoral College meet in states to vote for president and vice president. I'm Ryan Bank, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.